Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush Friday Interview Edition Filmmaker Series with my old friend Adam Pranica.
Oh, that's nice.
Who has a nice soap opera glow on his face.
You know, not enough people sing my name. I've been really missing that.
Sing my name, sing my name. Isn't that how that goes?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Hey, buddy. Good to see you.
Just great to see you. It's been a while since we've done one of these.
It has been a while. I think we both kind of secretly been sad about completing this project for now. As we all know, Paul Thomas Anderson has a film coming out this year, premiering at Cannes, I believe, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And kind of getting back to his, I don't know about his roots, but sort of a story less like There Will Be Blood and Phantom Limb and more like Boogie Nights, it sounds like.
Yeah, maybe he watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and he was like, fuck you, I can do it better.
Yeah, and of course it won't be like Boogie Nights, but it's sure. It's not a movie with probably people that are loathsome and awful.
I didn't realize this until I started doing a little bit of research for this film, but this is like, what, four period pieces in a row for Paul Thomas Anderson? And I hadn't realized that until reading that. And I'm kind of happy for him to go back to the Valley, at least. I know his next movie is going to be a period movie too, but like, he's such a, like, California and Paul Thomas Anderson are like hand in glove, you know?
Yeah, so before we get going, we like to talk about what we're drinking because that's what you and I do traditionally is.
Yeah.
We go at about 9 p.m. my time, 6 p.m. your time, and you're drinking a big old fishbowl of something. Is that a martini?
It is. I try to match my drink to the movie when it's possible.
Well, fuck, dude. Why didn't you tell me you were having a martini? I would have had a martini.
Well, the last time you and I talked martinis, you sprung it on me that you were having one, and I was like, oh, that sounds really nice. And then you took a picture from your bathtub where you were drinking it.
That is very true. I had a bathtub martini, like Arthur style.
Yeah.
I think that's the first time and only time I've ever done that, by the way. Because when you send someone a picture like that, what you're kind of saying is, I'm doing the ritual.
Right.
But it wasn't a ritual.
I've only ever had shower beers. I've never had bathtub martinis. I feel like you're doing it better.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah. Tonight I'm having a double martini in a giant punch bowl of a martini glass. And it's not clear because I'm using aged vermouth in here.
Okay. And give me just the rundown of what is in that thing.
Oh, it's St. George gin. Okay. It's this aged vermouth. It's a couple skeets of orange bitters. And then three olives.
All right. And you don't go dirty, right? You're just straight up.
I don't. But I used to. I feel like everyone's first martini is the dirty martini, right? Like that's the onboarding process for people when they start drinking martinis. I know it was mine. And most of my friends started out that way. But I am anti-dirty now. I am like, give it to me hot. Like that cold fire, right? Like an ice cold martini is one of the great flavors. I don't need the olive juice in there. Get it out of there.
Are you saying that I'm, you know, somehow a lesser martini drinker?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm stating my personal preference.
I'm
sharing with you my journey.
I know, but when you say things like, I feel like most jerk offs when they first try a martini, it's like this.
You know, you get a lot of people drinking martinis not in a bathtub, and it just sucks, man. That's just not the way to enjoy them. How do you like yours?
You know, I go dirty, but I go. I don't eat olives. I don't care for olives, but I do like that brine. So yeah. I go dirty with a lemon twist and a little vermouth as well. Sure,
I like that combo. So you have olives in the house. You don't eat the olives. You just, or do you buy the brine?
I buy Dirty Sue olive juice.
How about that?
Bottled and sent right to your door. Big fan of Dirty Sue.
Dirty Sue buys all the olives, makes the juice, and then just throws them away, right? Sounds like a real wasteful process, if you ask me.
Well, if Dirty Sue was smart, she'd be in bed with an olive oil maker.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I don't even know how they get the olive oil brine. I mean, that's not olive juice, is it?
It's a coincidence that Dirty Sue is also your stripper name.
It really is. I wish I'd had known. No problem. Not mad. As you can
do
see,
we...
I have a giant glass of red wine.
Yeah.
This glass is so big, I kind of want to hold it with two hands.
I'm used to seeing vessels that size made out of wood by a cooper.
I'm having Jacob Franklin Petit Syrah, Napa Valley.
Mm.
Really yummy.
You know, now that I'm living in California, you know, your next trip out here, we got to go up to wine country, man. Enjoy some wine hangs.
I'm all about it. In fact, I should just let you know, because we're going to do a wine trip with our best friends own a wine shop here in town right up the street.
Mm-hmm.
My like friend from college and his partner. And they have never been to Napa and Sonoma, so we're going to just do a trip with them at some point. I should just let you guys know when that's happening.
Please do. That'd be great.
You can just drive on up.
You and I have had some great wine hangs over the years. I'm looking forward to more.
Indeed. But I'll stick with the wine. My urge is to flush this down the toilet right now. Make a giant martini.
Just finish and then drop a pin in the time code here. You go up and get your second round.
Oh, boy. Well, this is already two rounds, so I think this will do it.
Yeah, I mean, how much of a bottle fits in that giant glass?
Well, I didn't want to have to go upstairs, so this is a hefty two glasses in one glass type
of thing. That's just being smart right there.
Yeah, that's doing it podcast style.
Yeah. Have you done another round on Movie Crush?
No, man, I haven't seen it yet. I have heard great things, and it is not just a cursory on my list. It is high, high on my list.
What a delight of a film that was.
Yeah, man, I can't wait. And of course, they're remaking it with, I think, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah. I mean,
what are you going to do?
I think I've learned not to approach a Leo DiCaprio movie with any sort of consternation, like...
I love Leo.
He's great. He's gonna
awesome.
He's gonna do a great job. But that original is a special film.
Yeah, I think I said it that way because it's just like, of course, amazing foreign film.
Mm-hmm.
American person goes, oh, well, let me do that same movie a couple of years later.
Yeah.
But I get it.
Yeah.
Can't leave money on the table, Adam.
You know who plays a great drunk? Leo DiCaprio. Not to go back to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but.
Oh, no.
That guy does a great act drunk. You know what I'm saying?
He does. He does. And I think we do it well in real life.
I know so. Classy drunks, you and me. The kind you want to be around. Like, no one likes an angry drunk, a thrower, or a yeller. We're just, we're gigglers. That's what I like.
Oh, boy. I remember the very first time I ever legit got drunk in college, because I didn't drink in high school. I was straight and narrow. But I got drunk my freshman year in college, and... Mm-hmm. These girls took me out, fellow freshmen who knew I didn't drink. They were like, oh, we're going to take you out and get you drunk.
Oh.
And so these two girls took me out, and I got drunk on Sex in the Beach. Sex is on the beach.
Uh-huh.
I don't even know what's in that still. I just know they were like, this is nice and fruity.
A lot of sugar, if I remember correctly.
And I just remember being in love with the world, man, for the very first time that I drank a lot like that. And they were just laughing. They were like, you're just loving life, aren't you? You're having fun. I said, oh, yes. Isn't that the goal?
I feel very fortunate to be wired the way that I am for consumption like this. I fully recognize and appreciate that many people aren't. Many people have the problem or the curse.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not cursed in that way, because I do enjoy what it does for me.
Yeah. You know what I've never done when I've been drinking? Wanted to start a fight.
No, yeah.
Or sober for that matter.
Yeah, no, not at all.
And you know what the main reason is? I don't ever want to get punched in the face in my life.
Yeah, that doesn't
no
sound
desire.
Good. Nor does it sound fun to punch anyone else in the face. It sounds very painful for the hand.
Yeah, It sounds a little more enjoyable than getting punched in the face.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, that's where I stop.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about it before. You and I are going to go pick a fight with somebody together.
Oh, right.
At some point. Or were we going to fight each other? There was something.
And the reason is, like, between the two of us, the odds are pretty good that one of us won't be punched in the face.
Right. All right, man. So let's get into it. We, of course, will cover that whenever the new PTA gets released.
Yeah.
We'll see that and do it live, or not live, but, you know, soon after it comes out.
Oh, yeah. Let's rent out a movie theater. It live.
I wonder if they're going to still do that.
God, I don't know.
Have you done that yet?
You're talking about
during COVID, like where you could rent a theater out for $100 or whatever.
I wanted to do that very badly, but no theaters within like hundreds of miles of me made that possible. So
LA didn't play that game. That's right. They were
no. I think you could do it in Seattle. I was envious of that, but I couldn't do it down here. Could you? Did you?
We can. I did not. My daughter went to a birthday party. Where her friends had rented a theater for like 13 girls, and Emily went to that. I was not able to go because I was podcasting, but she said it was a lot of fun.
I bet. I have not been back to a movie theater yet.
I still haven't either. I'm ready. I just, are they even open in LA yet? Probably not.
They are.
Oh, okay.
I understand the fun of ripping the Band-Aid off and going back to see like Godzilla versus King Kong or something, but I kind of want my first movie back to be like
good.
Yeah. You said
me too. I thought about A Quiet Place 2 this week.
Uh-huh.
And it never aligned with my schedule. And I think is supposed to be pretty good for what it is, but I'm kind of with you. I want it to be a great movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I do too. And I'm not up to speed on the release calendar either. I feel like things are just coming back online now to where we're starting to get an understanding of when your I don't know, when your tentpole movies are coming out.
Well, I know you and I mean, if we don't see Top Gun together, then there's something wrong.
Got to see Top Gun together.
I'll fly to LA to see Top Gun with you.
I got to tell you, I don't know if you edit things like this out of the show, so maybe you will, and I'm sorry for saying it. I quite coincidentally am poker buddies with the writer of the new Top Gun movie.
Oh, jeez.
And it is taking everything in my power not to just nerd out on this guy and ask a million questions.
Holy cow. Yeah, I'm not going to edit that out unless you feel like he would not want the world to know he plays poker.
No, I mean, the guy's super cool, and I'm like shaking playing poker, like with all the questions I have. But what a great movie. What a great opportunity for that, like to make that your first movie back. When is that supposed to be out?
I don't know. I mean, they've certainly got a backlog of films. They have that and the Bond movie and the Black Widow movie. They've got everything from last year.
Yeah.
And then they also started making movies again at some point. So I'm sure there's some other new stuff.
I got all these olives in front of me. I feel like I can't eat the olives on our show.
Because of misophonia?
I'm gonna eat an olive. I'm hoping you're gonna vamp here.
All right, I will vamp. Let's get into Phantom Thread. This is the last movie that he has made, because we've been going in order.
Mm-hmm.
This is another movie with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
This is a movie...
One of the great foreheads in all of film.
This is a movie that deviates from the father-son dynamic into a mother-son situation.
Yeah.
Even though the mother in this film has passed on, she does appear via a vision at one point, and she very much just looms large as a whole, don't you think?
It's a very Hereditary type scene when she appears, right?
It is. It looks like a horror movie for a second. Yeah. There. Yeah.
Yeah.
I kept waiting for something to happen there, and nothing did.
That was really elegantly done and not played for the jump scare or anything, just played for the mood. And it's such a mood film the whole way. It's very consistent like that.
It is. I think in another director's hands, you could veer into sort of horror movie territory with this movie.
Yeah.
If you wanted to, you'd have to change it up some, but not a whole lot.
It's interesting how much... how much genre decision can come down to the edit. Like, I think you could make this a horror film with no new scenes at all.
You think?
Just how you cut it. Like, you turn up the Johnny Greenwood a little bit, or maybe you get some weirder Johnny Greenwood, and all of a sudden, I think it's right there. Especially with how intense Daniel Day-Lewis is in this film. I mean, I watched this with my wife. I don't know if you watched this alone or not, and it was her first time watching it. And she's very much a fan of the costume period type of film. And my expectation was that she would love it.
Mm-hmm.
But she did not.
No.
And it was because of Woodcock's character. I just love saying that name. I'm going to say it as often as possible.
Well, I mean,
Reynolds Woodcock's character is...
Why do you name your character Woodcock?
I love it. Every time... I feel like they didn't overdo the dialogue that included that name either, very specifically, because they knew the absurdity of the name.
I guarantee you, and I agree with that, and I guarantee you that Paul Thomas Anderson very much chuckled to himself when he thought of that name.
Yeah, I mean, what I read is that he sort of pitched the idea to DDL and laughed about the name of the character. And that was one of the reasons he got him, he was able to get him involved in the film. Was like
the name?
It's hard to believe. It's strange credulity that, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis would just be phone buddies laughing about Reynolds Woodcock as a name. But from what I read, that's how this movie got put together.
Oh, that's hysterical.
Yeah.
I believe it too. That's funny.
Yeah.
It's a movie very much about power and the push and pull of that power. It's a movie with a great twist, kind of a double twist. And I even have here on my notes, like, the beginning music sounds like something out of a horror movie.
Yeah. I wonder, one of the questions I had for you, and like, just to tie off that comment about my wife watching this, I wonder how well this film has aged for you. Because I feel like for a long time, films about the asshole with a misunderstood genius complex and the enablers they surround themselves with was like sort of a genre of itself.
Yeah.
And seeing this through my wife's eyes, I understood how poorly that has aged. Because
was that one of her beefs?
Yeah. Yeah, like this guy's an asshole and he's cruel to people around him, and obviously he is, but I also found him funny, and there is a lot of comedy in this film.
That breakfast order for
one? Yeah, yeah. Big fun. Big, big fun.
I love it, man. He's ordering all this food. I thought I wrote it down.
I love how he doesn't order it all at once. It's like, oh, no, order a piece of it and then wait. And then another and then wait.
Yeah, Welsh rarebit, cream, butter. It's also sumptuous, you know, everything he's getting.
Yeah.
And bacon, some scones. And then at the very end, he just throws in and some sausages.
The move, I love this technique. Like, I'm not going to call it a seduction technique because I don't think this is something that Reynolds does all the time. Like, I don't feel like this is his move.
Yeah.
But and I felt for a long time, never do bits on tips. This is something that I say on the Greatest Generation show. Like when you're, be as nice as you can to a service industry person and don't fuck with them. And the idea,
you think you're funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't.
You're not. They're working for tips. So, the idea of taking away her written notes of the order and asking if she remembers, I have to say, it made me laugh. It was funny.
It was pretty funny, and it was also sort of a power control thing.
Yeah.
And I don't even think I answered your question a second ago. How's this age for me? I I know that was sort of a genre, but his movies and this movie is so like its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of just have it in its own capsule. I don't even think about it as like bad man in power.
Yeah.
Abusing the people around him, even though that's what's going on. And I this is only the second time I've seen it. Emily and I saw it together the first time. Really loved it.
In a theater?
I don't think so. I think we saw it at home.
Yeah.
And then this time it was a solo watch just because she wasn't here.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted to watch it again. She was kind of, or not upset, but just disappointed that she didn't get to watch it again.
Yeah.
And I really like the movie a lot. Like Paul Thomas Anderson is just like, he's doing something different every time out.
Yeah.
That you normally see in a film, and he's working on a different level. And I get that a lot of people don't like this stuff. We said this about The Master and There Will Be Blood. And that's, you know, I kind of admire someone just for making the movie he wants to make and not necessarily to please an audience.
Totally agree. And there are so few filmmakers who have that kind of latitude. Like,
yeah.
I don't want that to stop. I always want to see what Paul Thomas Anderson wants to do.
Yeah. I wonder how this came to him. Any idea?
Yeah.
Do you know?
I mean, what I read is he either watched a film or read something about Balenciaga as a fashion designer, and then he just sort of went down that rabbit hole of like the cult of personality there and came to it as kind of a new enthusiast, which is like so interesting that he chased down a new interest and mm-hmm. made a film about that. Like that, right. That feels like power to me. The power that Paul Thomas Anderson has as a filmmaker to just be permitted and to have a budget and go do his own thing is one thing. But as like a creative person,
yeah,
there's a separate but equal power that has to do with his interests. And those interests don't necessarily align with his strengths. Like imagine being Paul Thomas Anderson and knowing what your strengths are and going, I just learned about the fashion industry in this era. What if I could tell an interesting story here?
Yeah.
And then he goes and does it. I think that's really admirable.
It is. And I also wonder if, you know, of course, Daniel Day-Lewis has supposedly retired after this film. And I believe him.
Do you?
I do.
I think he's like a boxer. I think
back.
You're picking up the phone, aren't you? If you're him, because you know, if the phone is ringing, you're getting someone's best pitch.
You want to know what's out there, but he's been getting the best pitch for a while.
Yeah.
He didn't have to fake retirement.
God, I don't know.
I don't know. We'll see. But I wonder how much he, when he was picking his films, I wonder how much he would choose them based on like, well, I'm going to have to learn to sew now. Like, because he very famously goes super method and learns how to do these things, whether it's becoming a full-on carpenter or learning how to really sew a dress. So I wonder if he, like that, that's a lot of, I'm kind of joking, but I'm kind of not. I mean, that's a lot of baggage to come with a film. Like,
yeah.
Do I have it in me to learn how to be a, probably not a master seamstress or anything, or seamster? What would you call it?
Oh, I like seamster. It has to be wrong, but.
Yeah.
But that's why I like it.
Yeah. I'm just curious about that. If he even considers that stuff, like I'm going to have to do this because that's my process.
That's got to be part of the fun of being an actor, though, too, is trying on the character and living in him for as long as it takes. I mean, you're right about his intensity and his reputation as an intense person requires that. I mean, it looks believable throughout when you see him.
Yeah.
I read that Vicky Creeps, is that how I pronounce her last name? Do you know?
I didn't look it up, but I believe if she's of... German heritage, which I think she is, right?
All right. I apologize if it's not correct. I'm going to stay consistent.
I think it's Creeps if it's IE.
Like, she met DDL on set, like on the first day of shooting, which has got to be like probably the best way to do it because you don't want to get to your wagon a week ahead of time and like, you know, the deal with DDL, you got to call him by his character name and do all that. But like, yeah, but like for it to just be on day one of the shoot, Like, that's how I think you want to work with him. Like, without having to get used to the weirdness.
And you're going to be intimidated either way. So it's not like one is any better than the other as far as, like, making you, like, relax.
I wonder if DDL had to, like, I call him DDL like he's Diamond Dallas Page or, I just love that.
Yeah.
I wonder if he had to, like, suppress, because he is so method, the eating of giant breakfasts like that. Uh-huh. Like, I wonder if he always had to have cream and sausages and all of that.
I bet he did.
Yeah.
Breakfast is a big part of this movie.
Yeah.
Like, not even being funny. There are a lot of scenes.
Great breakfast movie.
Around that breakfast table.
Yeah.
And the ritual that he needs, which is to have a I kind of like his style. Like, I'm into a nice quiet morning as well, which, you know, you can't have anymore once you have a kid. But to me, there's nothing wrong if you have no kids, if you're married or in a relationship and you live with someone, waking up and not saying much to each other for the first hour or so is fine.
Oh, yeah. That's the dream, right?
And I'm not groggy or grumpy or anything, but there's something about putting on some music and just having a very slow start to the day that is really appealing to me.
Is toast the loudest food?
It was when she, that scene was pretty funny too. There was a lot of humor in this movie.
And I love, like, it's not just the buttering of the toast. Like, there's the scene later on where they're out on the veranda having breakfast and she's like chewing. She's like biting into the toast in such a great way. And the rack in on Woodcock's face. This is right after they got married. I think this is their honeymoon.
Right.
And he, like, looks out in the middle distance like, my God, what have I done?
Right.
I'm stuck with this for breakfast forever.
Yeah. I mean, the sound design is very kind of funny in those scenes because the one where they're inside with his sister, which we'll get to her in a second.
Yeah.
My God, what a acting role. It is so sound designy to maximize the sound of the knife being put back on the plate, the buttering of the toast, the chewing, the pouring of the tea, which she does, you know, with a little flair that he liked at first.
There's
when she was serving him, but not
there's
now.
A 90s SNL sketch that Will Ferrell is in that is like, that sole conceit is an angry father at his family, and the sound is turned up so hot on the dinner plates and the sound of silverware on those plates as a passive-aggressive sound. And I know PTA is a big SNL fan. I wonder if that inspired the intensity of these scenes, because it's so fun and funny to me.
Well, and though it's, you know, it's kind of funny and all, but it really serves a purpose in this film, because not only is she disrupting his breakfast, but then there's when she learns how to quietly butter her toast. Like, that all comes back around, and, you know, she's now being a good little girl around this guy who can't have her making any noise, which is really obnoxious.
Yeah. Do you ever feel like she's broken? Because I don't. I feel like this film very specifically chooses to onboard her power early so that we aren't feeling sorry for Alma's character. Like, we do initially, like, too soon. Like, you're like, oh, man, like, don't tell her to wipe off her lipstick. Like, that.
Yeah.
Like, that's shitty.
Yeah.
But almost immediately, like, way before halfway through the film, she calls him out on his bullshit. Like, the only thing, I only think you're acting strong line is, like, her like, throwing down the gauntlet. Like, fuck you. I know who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so important. Like, where in time in the film that happens. So you're not feeling sorry for Alma or thinking that she's a victim of Woodcock's deal. And, like, one of the things my wife asked was, like, where are Alma's parents? And to me, I was like, Alma's parents would be fucking thrilled in 1950s.
Yeah.
What country is this in? Is this in,
this is
in England?
Yeah,
like in 1950s England, post-war England, for a waitress to hook up with rich,
world-renowned fashion.
Yeah, person. Yeah.
No, I totally agree.
There is that tension, though. I think, like, you want to make sure she's okay, but she really is. She's a strong character.
And she displays that in a few ways. You know, she has that one line that you were talking about with him. And it's a little bit later, but she stands up to Cyril when she wants to give him the surprise party.
Yeah.
And Cyril is more frightening than anyone in this movie.
She's so
maybe more frightening than anyone in any movie ever.
She's
the great
incredible.
Leslie Manville. Oh man, she's incredible. But
yeah,
so intimidating. And that, God, that one where she just fucking eviscerates her brother with that one scene, man, it shows who really has the power.
I love it so much.
It's
I love that scene, and I love her in it. It's great how she never raises her voice, like, ever.
Yeah. She doesn't.
Her power comes from her choice of words and, like, the economy of those words. It's great.
Yeah, it's great. But so she stands up to Cyril. I mean, all throughout the movie, she's taking control. She goes to the dance by herself on New Year's Eve. She goes with him. She makes the choice to sort of be his hero in getting that dress off the lady.
Another,
like, she's constantly making empowering decisions until straight through to the end when she's, you know, ultimately in power all along.
I love that scene where they take the lady's dress off together, because that... Yeah. I feel like that's the first time you get the sense that they're a team.
Yes.
Especially in the wedding, even before that even happens, like, Alma is almost more angry about the situation than Woodcock. They're like,
oh yeah,
at that wedding table together watching this dress get fucked up, and she's like almost shaking with anger about it. It's one of the aspects of the film and her character that makes you believe she's going to be okay, and she has agency, and she's, like, she's in it for herself. Like, I stop worrying about her at that moment in a good way.
Yeah, and this movie, I could see the same story being so different in different filmmakers' hands.
Yeah.
And she really, like, has so much respect for him. It's never like, oh, you're just an abusive monster, and I'm under your thumb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she takes control, like I said, and she at the very beginning, those bookended sort of confessional scenes where you later learn that she's speaking to the young doctor.
Yeah.
But she calls him the most amazing man. And this is all in the future, you know?
I think you need that, too, to begin the film, to be grounded in the idea that she's going to be okay. She's always going to be okay.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. I think without those bookends, it feels a little more sketchy in a way you don't want.
Yeah.
This film, like tonally, it's weird what does the work, right? Like, the dialogue is so efficient and cutting that it's doing a lot of the work, but also the sound design of this film is something that I love. And the house is a character.
Yeah.
Those footsteps on the wood floor.
Yeah.
Really emphasize the emotional states of the characters inside that house. And I love how turned up they are. I love how you can hear people stomping around.
Oh yeah. And that first beautiful shot up the stairwell into the light. That's one of my, I mean, it's a movie shot we've seen a bunch of times, but this is one of the best uses of it.
Yeah.
Is looking up through, not a spiral staircase, but just, you know, multiple floors of stairs kind of winding around one another.
Yeah.
And there's, I don't know, man, he makes just the most beautiful movies. There's such a sumptuous quality to his period work.
Yeah.
They're authentic and gorgeous. And, like, there's never a frame that doesn't look like, well, that's exactly how it probably looked back then.
I read that he very, and by he, I mean Paul Thomas Anderson, really specifically did not want super clean film. Like, he didn't want this to look digital at all. Like, he really wanted this to look, like, promised it a little bit, like a little foggy, a little dusty, a little imperfect, in a way that really adds character to the locations here. Like, for as wealthy as Woodcock has to be, for as large as he lives in his home, like, I never really got the sense that he had a nice home. It was just big, and it served him as a place to do his work, right?
Yeah. I mean, and I think, like, our idea of nice these days is so different. Like, and you don't even have to be into modern homes, but I think everything has to be so pristine, and the white, you know, quartzite countertops, and that's just sort of the look these days. It's very crisp and clean, whether it's a Craftsman or a modern. And back then, these were ancient houses that were lived in with old furniture, and it was post-war England that was, and England was just a fucking mess after the war. They don't really talk much about it, but it's sort of there.
Do you think that Reynolds was a veteran?
No.
Wouldn't? Why not?
I don't know, man. It doesn't.
I agree with you too, but I can't
feel like it.
Yeah. Wouldn't he have been, or because he was part of the aristocracy, you think that wasn't what he would have? No, I'm saying, like, because he was of a certain social status, like,
oh, right, sure.
He wouldn't have been.
I don't know. Or he was too old, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, if he's playing his age, he's what, like mid-50s?
I guess so.
And that would have been, but this is in the 50s, so it could have potentially been 10 years earlier, but maybe in his 40s during the war? And how old is she?
I mean, things were pretty desperate for a time in Europe and in England. I wonder what happened to men of his age at that time.
Rally around the old calls there, boy.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I love all those driving shots too. When you attach a camera to a car, like either the hood of the car or the trunk of the car, it's just a cool shot. I love it. It always feels dangerous.
It's very Lawrence of Arabia, right? Like like in the way that film depicted fast motorcycle driving in a way that felt like Chekhov's motorcycle. Like it made me feel nervous for him, but it seemed like so much fun. You get in a low slung sports car and drive like that. Like, I was envious of all of those scenes. That had to be great fun. And if you're Daniel Day-Lewis, like, you're actually driving the car.
Totally. Yeah. What's funny is too, later on when she, and this is as on the nose as Paul Thomas Anderson gets metaphorically, but when she's sort of taking control, she literally gets in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
And drives him that one night. And it didn't occur to me the first time I saw it, but I was like, that's kind of funny. Like, he was like, all right, she's in the driver's seat of this relationship now. Let's literally put her in the driver's seat.
That kind of, I feel like that was the moment she tested the boundaries of what she would be permitted to do as a caretaker figure for him, right? Like, that's the first time she slides over and she's like, I've got it. And it's what... And when he allows it, that feels like a really big moment. It's not the same as being weakened by illness and being cared for by her later, but I think it's related.
I think so too. And I think the power switch comes early, like you said, because she realizes that he needs her.
Yeah.
Probably more than she needs him in a way.
Yeah.
Because she could go off and... pretty young woman and marry the doctor or whoever she wants, you know, and he's much more limited. Like, that, I mean, you get the feeling there have been a bunch of women before her because of the way they introduced the one lady there at first.
Yeah. And then Cyril runs her out,
falling out of fashion a bit, and he's older. And
that scene on New Year's was so carefully done, because I think that's the scene that supports your argument. Because we see her as youthful and energetic and capable of meeting new people and socializing, she's not desperate for him. And we don't see her making out with someone.
Right.
Or like, that wasn't a scene of her stepping out on him.
Yeah, which is very key.
But it was a message sent that she could. And
God,
it
how great did that scene look?
So great.
Holy shit. Great.
What a fun party that looks like. Like, so often you see a party scene in a film and you're like, that's a film party scene.
Yes. Yeah. Is that an elephant?
That doesn't look like that would be that much fun, but this party looks like so much fun.
Yeah. It was amazing. I mean, he dropped some serious cash on that, you know, 5-minute scene.
Anytime you drop balloons in a scene, you better get it. You can't go back to one after the balloons drop.
Very hard to reset that.
Yeah.
I have here in my notes too, Adam, I think you'll appreciate this, is going back to the beginning with their first date. Is there ever more of a time to get up and run out of a restaurant than when your date tells you he has a lock of his mother's hair sewn into his coat jacket?
Yeah.
That should have been it for her. She should have been like, all right, I'm out. Thank you.
Maybe that played differently in the 50s.
Maybe. It's funny.
I did love that trivia, though, right? Like the idea of the grates sewing something into the lining. I think that's cool.
Oh, is that a thing?
Yeah, that's what he mentions. Like,
did he actually?
And then that's like the little note that got sewn into the. She wasn't a queen. She was.
Yeah, some sort of princess or something.
Yeah, like that note that.
God, I can't remember now.
I wish I remembered.
Yeah. But yeah, sure. And she takes it out. Power
move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big power move.
She's always usurping his power. Yeah. I mean, this movie, if you don't even watch closely, then you might think this is a movie about a young woman who's being controlled by this older man. And it's really not what's going on at all.
Right. It's that soft power, which is often the biggest power behind the scenes.
Well, and the power of the muse, it's a very valuable, like, you know, you're an asset if you are the muse of someone who needs it.
Never cursed.
Never cursed.
Is right. What's sewn into the stitching. And that was a callback to the conversation they had earlier where, you know, there's so much superstition around wedding dresses in this time. Like, you don't want to touch one if you're unmarried and on and on.
That was
pretty fun trivia, too, that I wasn't aware of.
I thought it was interesting that these siblings, like, I keep wanting to call them Plainview, Woodcock has his ritual when he meets her, which was to take
Plainview Woodcock is my porn name.
Is to take away her writing pad, kind of quiz her in a way on whether or not she remembers, but also have this keepsake to take home. So that was his power move. And Cyril's, do you remember the first thing she does? She fucking smells her.
That's right.
Like an animal.
Yeah.
And calls out everything she'd eaten and everything she's wearing, what kind of soap she used. I mean, talk about a power move, man.
There is a real element to like her being cattle.
Yeah.
In that scene. Like all measured up and
that's the only time I really felt bad for her, because the dynamic shifted so quickly when Cyril came in there. She gets smelled down, and when he's measuring her and barking out her measurements so coldly, like she's a mannequin, that's the only time where I see her really, like, I mean, not suffering, but you know what I mean.
There's a neutrality to Vicky Creeps' performance there, though, that I think kind of saves it from that creep factor. And I don't know if this is just me projecting or not, but I mean, so much of that scene is thrilling for her. It's a little bit Pretty Woman, right? Like she was a waitress days ago.
Yeah.
And now she's getting measured for a dress that in 1,000 years she'd never be able to afford by the best dressmaker in her country. Like there's elements of that too. And it's a great, like, what a first impression between her and Cyril.
Yeah, I mean, that whole scene was meant to put her, to let her know her place in that situation.
And nothing dehumanizes like measurements, though, right?
Well, and remember what he says, too. He says, you have no breasts.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says, you're perfect. It's my job to give you some if I choose to.
If I choose to.
Yeah, those three words there at the end, man.
Is the line.
Words, I guess. Yeah, that's the line.
Yeah. So great.
And it's right there, sort of at the end of that first act, that things start to turn a little bit. I mean, she's basically told that her taste is incorrect. She's not allowed to have an opinion. And you really think this movie is going in that direction hard. And she's not having it, though.
I like how you never see her dressed poorly. Like, she's dressed for work when you first meet her.
Mm-hmm.
But you never see her, like, wearing rags. This isn't, like, the literal rags to riches story.
Yeah,
and totally. I like that about this film. Like, her transformation goes from, you see her at work, and she's dressed nice and neat mm-hmm. for her shift. And then you see her later, and she's dressed up for her date. And she looks great for the date. And then from then on, you never see her not looking amazing in something that was made for her.
I love the casting of her because she was basically an unknown in the United States, very pretty and just has that great European look to her face. And it would have just ruined it, I think, if he would have tried to cast some American actor.
She's really beautiful, but she's also really, like, she's got that Sarah Paulson vibe where she could be anyone in any movie.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like she could be anything in a way that's got to be exciting for any actor. Like, I hope she's getting called for all of it and just turning a bunch of shit down that she doesn't want to do. Because I feel like she would fit right in to whatever you're making.
I feel like I saw her not in something, but that she was going to be in something soon. Just like a couple of days ago. Or maybe she was in a trailer or something.
Yeah.
But she didn't like just blow up all. I mean, this is what, like 4 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, there was no rocket career trajectory after this. But I don't feel like that's how it works with ensemble Paul Thomas Anderson films.
Yeah.
Really. Like, he's not a star maker like that.
Yeah. I think you're right. Because these movies, I mean, they're not, there's an audience for them, but the audience for Phantom Thread wasn't huge. Like, I don't know what this did at the box office, but serious film lovers is who goes and sees these.
I wonder, to use a film analogy, if, like, you know how some athletes are painted as like a system quarterback, like that quarterback played great for that team because the system made them great.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you get painted with that brush if you're in a Paul Thomas Anderson film or similar, where you get that great director brush on you and the reputation is, well, yeah, she's great, but she was in a Paul Thomas Anderson film and that's why. And I wonder if that like hurts you as an actor in a weird way.
I don't know. I mean, I bet she's been busy in Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's her jam. She's just, you know, not everyone wants to, like, I feel like the woman in, Inglourious Basterds
mm-hmm.
kind of did a couple of bigger mainstream movies here and then I think was content to stay in Europe for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to stay in Europe. You don't want to come out here.
So let's talk about the power shift a little bit. I think, I mean, this, like I said, you know, a few times, this movie is all about power and then it going from one to the other. And I think when it really happens for the first time, like they spend a little bit of that beginning sort of dehumanizing her somewhat, is when he is broken from work for the first time and she cares for him and realizes that she loves that feeling of this powerful man being brought to his knees and her being the key to nursing this great person back to doing their great work. Big foreshadowing of what's to come, obviously, but I think that's really when that turn happens.
Yeah. Yeah, and her performance is so subtle that when she recognizes that, it's fun. Like it's not too much later that she's back out in the forest getting mushrooms, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, which you don't know exactly what's going on at first.
Yeah.
And then they make it pretty obvious.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they make that. They hold that till the very end to reveal, like it shows her reading about the poison stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the reveal of the film is that he's into it when that moment comes, but the road there is so delicious.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
I want to talk about it now, but we'll get to that. I love the Barbara Rose stuff, you know, the lady they take the dress off of.
Yeah.
Because she functions as this, again, it's all about, this movie's all about power. Like, he detests that she has the power over his life somewhat. Mm-hmm.
That he needs her.
He has to do this work for her.
Yeah.
Because she pays him a lot of money to do it.
It's interesting, like, you hear about her before she shows up, and you're like, oh, what is she going to be like? She's going to be awful.
She wasn't that bad.
And that's what my point was going to be, is, like, she's a rich debutante. Like she's
sort,
just...
sort of unhappy, I think.
She's just an unhappy rich drunk.
Yeah.
Who's not mean to him, or, like, I'm sure you've been in professional relationships where that feel parasitic, where you're like, oh, I got to do this thing and this person is being shitty to me.
Right.
But that isn't what's going on here. Like, he just seeks a purity in how his work is treated. And because she isn't capable of that, that's the hang up.
Right. And he hates, like, I think Cyril even says that she pays for this house.
Yeah. Which is what makes the risk of taking the dress off of her feel so filled with tension. Like, is he sacrificing something greater than we think in that moment? I mean, clearly not, because he gets to keep his house, but...
Something tells me that Barbara Rose is one who would sober up and still want to him to do work for her.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she's embarrassed and she knows she's a loathsome drunk.
I love that scene, like when they first access her penthouse or whatever at the wedding. Mm-hmm. Barbara Rose's handler is on the scene and is just like incapable of.
Oh, man, she's so outclassed.
Yeah,
she's in bed.
She brought a knife to a gunfight there for sure.
You want the dress? She's in bed.
Yeah,
and then Vicky is the one who, like, he doesn't even shove her through the door, like. You said earlier, she's all about going to get that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, which I love. It was a big moment when she did that. It changed the tone of her whole character.
Well, and it's right after that that she stands up to Cyril about the birthday party.
Yeah.
And boy, that scene was, to see how discombobulated he was, for his routine to be disrupted and that house to be empty. And, like, how many times did he ask where Cyril was?
Right.
In those, that first, like, minute.
Yeah.
When did she leave? Where's Cyril? Where's Cyril? When's she coming back? It was like,
it became kind of pathological.
Yeah, and creepy again.
Yeah.
He's like a man-child almost.
Well, I mean, it is that enabler thing, right? He needs... Like, I feel like he is self-aware enough to know that his behavior is boorish.
Sure.
But what he has is Cyril in his back pocket. Cyril making it okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if no one was around to make it okay, maybe he'd be capable of changing the way he treats people. But as long as you don't have that check, Cyril's just going to keep kicking the Joannas of the world out of his house for all time.
And Vicky becomes that check.
Yeah.
And it's at that dinner scene where they finally have it out, and she calls him out. And that scene is actually has some pretty funny stuff too, when he's, where's your gun? Show me your gun. Have you come to kill me? Where's your gun? Like, that's so funny. And I know he was trying to get a laugh out of that.
How surprised were you in the scene where Cyril says that she likes Alma?
Pretty surprised, actually.
Me too.
That was as big of a reveal as anything, almost.
I love that moment, because I like feeling like Alma won her over. Mm-hmm. And it was especially good feeling that I didn't know that it had happened until she said it.
I agree.
It was a nice reveal.
Is it that thing, though, where someone stands up to the asshole, and then the asshole then respects them? Is that what happened there?
But I think it's interesting that Alma doesn't know that. Like, Cyril never tells Alma that. I think she treats her a little better going forward. But if you ask Alma from then on, if she's found herself on Cyril's good side, I think Alma would say, no, she hates me as much as ever.
Right. But does Cyril get that respect because Alma did stand up to her?
Absolutely.
But she would never give her that.
I mean, what's interesting is, like, in that early scene where you recognize Cyril's power when she kicks out Joanna, I feel like Joanna is resistant to Cyril, like, in a way that, why didn't Joanna make it work in that same way? I don't know.
Well, Joanna didn't do it in a clever way. She was more sort of stomping her feet about her situation.
Yeah.
And Alma and Vicky was much more clever.
That had to be it, right? Yeah, you're just calling her by her actor name.
I know, that's weird.
You're very familiar with Vicky Creeps. You're kind of being a Vicky Creep, Chuck.
I'm being a Vicky Creep. No, Alma is much more clever. And I think, I bet you there's been a lot of women to come through in that role as living mannequin slash toast butterer. And I think that Alma is the most capable, the smartest, the most clever, the strongest. And I think game respect game. And Cyril knows that.
I like that I never got the feeling that this was coming from a place where Alma's got nothing to lose. Like, I think we've seen this movie before where the Alma of the film rags to riches herself into a position where, like, what does she care if she fucks this up? She's going to go back to her waitress job and things are going to be fine. That is not suggested at all.
Yeah.
She acts in her interest in a way that is completely uncoupled from any sort of consequence. And I like not knowing that. I like not cutting to her in her room in the home after she gets into an altercation with Cyril and her, like, heavily breathing, like, holy shit, like, should I have done that?
Yeah.
You never get a sense of Alma's inner life.
Yeah.
In a way that I think you would get in a lot of other films. And I think this
you totally would.
Makes Alma a stronger character. Like, making her a little less known works in her favor and makes her stronger.
Yeah, and I think that's also a reason why she is a person unto herself. There is no best friend. There is no sister. There are no parents. Like, there, because normally in a movie like this, she would call her sister or her friend and talk about what's going on in this house of horrors or whatever. And she's totally just, I mean, this movie has a very isolating feeling, kind of like There Will Be Blood in some ways.
You know what? Come to think of it, like, no one has an inner life in this movie. No one gets that moment to step back and think and regret or fear or hope or anything. Everything is played out in front of someone else, isn't it?
I'm trying to think if there's a single scene with someone by themselves.
No, I don't think there is. And I think that's part of what makes so many of the interactions in this film feel fraught or dangerous or filled with tense tension.
Yeah.
And then you slather the Johnny Greenwood on that and, like, forget it.
Spreading butter on toast.
Oh, yeah. Very loud toast. That's Johnny Greenwood.
Yeah. So you got Johnny Greenwood and you also have some classical pieces here and there. Really works for the movie. It wasn't Johnny Greenwood from There Will Be Blood. Like, I love his range.
Yeah.
Because that would have made it feel like a horror movie, I think.
I love, like, Johnny Greenwood in There Will Be Blood is like 9 out of 10.
Yeah.
Strength. And I feel like he dialed it down to like a 4 here.
Totally.
And it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that, like, the edit that you detect is a bad edit. I feel like music works that way too, right? Like, this is adding to the feeling instead of making itself the star of the moment.
Right. Yeah, which is what you would get in a Merchant Ivory. Like, this is probably PTA's stab at a Merchant Ivory type of thing.
Yeah.
In his own sort of fucked up way.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially because the film is so interested in the diegetic sounds of the life, like of the life in that house, the stomping and the clinking and the toast and all of that.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the breakfast scene. See what exactly what Cyril says. Because like you said, though, it's really the way she says it more so than the actual lines.
Yeah.
Because in my head, you know, I'm thinking she says, like, I will fucking end you. She doesn't say that.
Right.
It's the don't pick a fight.
Right.
All right, here we go. Here we go.
Would you like me to ask Alma to leave?
No. Why?
Well, if you're going to make her a ghost, go ahead and do it, but please don't let her sit around waiting for you. I'm very fond of her.
Oh, you're very fond of her, are you? Well, in that case...
No, don't turn it on me. I don't want your cloud on my head.
Shut up, Sue.
You can shut right up. Don't pick a fight with me. You certainly won't come out alive. I'll go right through you, and it'll be you who ends up on the floor. Understood?
Oh, man.
I've never been more scared of a character in a Paul Thomas Anderson film than after that line.
Or any movie. Like, yeah. That's one of the scariest scenes in any movie, I think. That's so great, man. I wonder if I can get sued for that.
It's so interesting how Leslie Manville's physicality isn't there in this movie. Like, she never gets in anyone's face. She never points a finger.
No.
She never raises her voice.
Yeah.
And that scene is so emblematic of this. It's like, I feel like she's holding her teacup or something when she says it.
Yeah,
like,
she's drinking and slurping. And
it's so casually delivered in a way that like the most powerful people are able to do. Like it would be nothing for her to destroy him.
Yeah. And that's 30 seconds. And you two humongous things happen there, which is you really finally see who truly is the beast in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And who has control. And you also know for sure that she is sticking up for Alma in a big way.
Yeah.
Like you can't treat her like, who was the first one?
Joanna. Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to let you do that.
I wonder how close they came to, like, obviously this is a Daniel Day-Lewis joint, but like you could fill a lot of this movie with Leslie Manville up to the level of Daniel Day-Lewis minutes. And I think the movie becomes better and better when you do.
Give me a prequel.
That's what I'm saying. Like
just
I could
about her.
I could use the 8 episode HBO Max miniseries. That's just Cyril.
Yeah.
And Cyril's life.
I think she was nominated. Did she win an Oscar?
Oh boy, I do not know that.
I'm pretty sure she was nominated.
She's deserving of all the things for this.
Yeah, I mean, I have so much respect for these roles that are just played between the forehead and the chin, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the control of it. And imagine being in a film with DDL and like toe-to-toe.
Yeah.
Toe to fucking toe. Like, she is not diminished next to him at all. She's incredible.
Yeah. I bet when she read this script and saw that specific scene, and she's like, I'm going to go up against Daniel Day-Lewis basically and tell him I own his ass. like, what an opportunity for an actor.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
I love how... You know, like you do this with wardrobe, right? Like a character is put together and finished and in control when you look at them. Like if their costuming is perfect and on point, and this is one of those films that makes that clear. Like when Reynolds is dressed, he's a beautiful man and he looks put together. But like the way you suggest that he's unwell is with his hair.
Yeah.
And like there's that fallen samurai quality to him. Like when his hair kind of falls out a little bit.
Yeah.
When he's sick, that's how you can tell when he's fucked up.
Yeah.
I love how they do that.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember the first time I saw this. Like, I was really thrown. Like, I didn't have any spoilers going into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me
and
too.
I thought, you know, I thought she was maybe trying to kill him slowly and get away with it. I think maybe that's the implication if you haven't seen the film.
Because 1,000 movies have told that exact story.
Yeah. And, oh boy, like, what a stroke of genius idea to, like, turn that on its head and yank the rug out from under the viewer.
Yeah.
To not only have this be a control thing for her, but, like you said, the big ending, man. I mean, what did you think the first time you saw that and you realized that he was into it? What a scene.
I mean, I think I probably laughed, but I laughed
right.
not because it was funny. I just laughed at the audacity and the realization of that being the reveal. I loved it. I loved it the first time I saw it, and I loved it in the subsequent viewings of the movie. It's so satisfying to suspect that it's coming from a dark place, but instead realize that that it's sympathetic. Like, it's both characters taking something from this arrangement and getting what they need. It's really brilliant. It's brilliant in a way that doesn't make you feel dirty either. Right. You know, like, this, again, I feel like so many scenes that we talk about when we talk about this film are like, wow, they really avoided the big mistake here.
Mm-hmm.
The cliche is what they avoided. And this is another example of that. Like,
yeah,
it could have, this film car could have rolled into the ditch in this moment, especially, and it didn't. Instead, it's like the strength of the actors in this scene make it make sense and make it understandable. Yeah.
I think, actually, thinking back, I'm pretty sure I was a little confused at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm brave enough to admit that. I wasn't right away like, oh my God, he was into it. I think it was more like Emily and I were both like, what just happened? Was he into that?
Yeah.
And this is the kind of movie that, you know, I dive right into the internet afterward.
Uh-huh.
And it's quickly confirmed. I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what was going on. Because it's such an unconventional thing to do. I don't feel too bad for being a little confused.
I really like reading scripts. I haven't read this script, but I've got to believe that the parenthetical for this performance for Daniel Day-Lewis is like, Reynolds Woodcock eats the mushrooms at Alma.
Right.
like that's the vibe. Direction. Like the omelets in front of him and the tension of just sort of chopping it up.
Yeah. Looking right at her face.
Looking right at her.
Uh-huh.
And taking it down, like,
he eats the mushrooms at Alma.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that look on his face. It's weird. He has this, it's almost like, and I think upon this viewing, and this is where I sort of gathered this, was that he has this primal desire almost to lose control and to be submissive and to be taken care of. But I don't even think he understands that. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I wonder if it's like,
she brought it out in him, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, so many disordered thoughts or interests in the 1950s, I feel like were, you know, whispered
right
about. I don't believe that Reynolds, like, there's probably not a name for what this is.
In right.
It borders
on sadomasochism in a way.
Right. But I don't, you know, if this were happening today, I think it would very easily have that label. But back then, I think Reynolds has got to just be titillated by what he's feeling without a name for it.
Yeah, I mean, part of me thinks he had this primal desire that she tapped into that he didn't know was there. Like, it happened, and he was like, oh, I like the way that felt. Because I'm a person that has to control my environment down to the tenor of the breakfast sounds. And to give that control up appealed to him in a way that I don't think he realized it would. Or maybe she just didn't bore him.
You know what? This is like the 10th time we're going to ring this bell here. But this film doesn't turn into Misery here.
Yeah.
In a way it so easily could have. Like, and I think it's fixed with dialogue. Like, Alma... And this isn't secret dialogue either. This isn't just Alma talking to her doctor friend about him.
Right.
Like, they allude to this, Alma and Reynolds, between each other. Like, they talk around what this relationship dynamic is.
Yeah.
When he's sick, in a way that helps. It helps unmisery the moment in a way that makes you believe where you have to believe it at the end of the film that she's not trying to kill him.
And that they're good.
Yeah. They're good with it.
Like, and not just good with it, but they're like
good with each other.
Good with each other. And I feel like he has finally released this hold of control that has allowed him to be free in a way. And she has gained this power that she probably didn't know she ever had. And the way she talks about him in those bookended scenes with the doctor, it's all right there, man. She's smiley.
I've got a great relationship with my wife, and I'm fortunate to say that. I love her a lot. Yeah. But if you told me that like 4 days of diarrhea would make our relationship like 25% better.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. What about you? Wouldn't you take it?
I would eat that omelet so fast.
Hell yeah. I mean,
let's say you're at 90%.
I've already got 4 days of diarrhea per month.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's
unfair. I don't
even
like mushrooms.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems like a fair trade, especially for the road that Reynolds has been on.
Yeah.
It seems like he's found the one. It's a happy ending, right?
I wonder what the end game is. I wonder where these people are in 5 years. You can't keep poisoning yourself like that and not have some sort of long-term effect, right?
I wouldn't think so. And I think
more
eventually
than just diarrhea, probably.
You chase that mushroom dragon long enough, you're just going to keep eating more and more of these things.
Yeah,
I think that's
more.
Probably a bad deal.
Yeah. Does it end up in an accidental killing?
Yeah. I mean, in the 50s, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think Reynolds is dead in 2 years. Like, and I'm betting the under.
This isn't one of those movies, though, where I kind of delight in thinking, like, where do these characters go from here? Like, these movies are best sort of left as they are.
You know what's interesting about the triangle of Cyril and Reynolds and Alma is that Cyril never knows what Alma's doing to Reynolds. And
yeah.
If she did, it would never work. It would never be worth it. And so, like, to think about a timeline where Reynolds is dead and it's the Alma and Cyril show, that's big fun.
Yeah.
The Phantom sequel.
Yeah, why is this called The Phantom Thread?
Is that the name of the thing that you stitch into someone's lining? I don't know. I don't know why.
I don't think they said
I wasn't
that.
Able to find that.
Yeah, I don't know either. By the way, thank you for sending me that Instagram. I meant to shout that out, and I was waiting for you. The what's it called? The Color Palette Cinema? Is that
Color
is
Palette
that
Cinema? Yeah, I sent that to you because I just recently found out that you yourself had an Instagram. I've known you for years.
Well,
I found
it's pretty
out,
new.
I found out a month ago that you had it.
I've only had it for about 6 months, so
yeah.
I haven't been on for long.
It's great.
Yeah, I enjoy it. But yeah, Color Palette Cinema, you guys, on Instagram has film stills and then a color chart.
Yeah, swatches, basically.
Yeah, swatches of the color palette of that scene. And, you know, a lot of times that scene is indicative of that movie as a whole.
Yeah.
Very cool stuff. And you sent me the master, I think, right? Or was it There Will Be Blood?
I think I sent you the master. It's very much like I feel like you could pitch the idea for this Instagram by starting with Wes Anderson, like a very in your face color palette type of filmmaker.
Yeah.
But you realize when you follow an account like this, just how many filmmakers work in these tones.
Yeah,
tones that, cool. that become their own. And I feel like speaking of Wes Anderson, like Phantom Thread feels like a Wes Anderson film shot at 45 degree angles instead of head on. I feel like every scene is fixed in a way that unlike Wes Anderson is a little less fixed. You know, it doesn't make its like composition doesn't make itself the star of the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely PTA's least showy film, camera-wise, I think. There are a few here and there, but it's pretty locked down.
I read that he wanted Bob Elswit for it, and he wasn't available, and so it was cinematography by committee. Like, that's the legend of this film is that PTA shot it himself, but he's denied that and said that it was by committee. But whatever the truth is, it's a really beautiful film.
It is, as they all are.
Yeah.
It makes me sad that this project is almost over. We got the one more coming up, but we'll just have to think of what else we want to do.
We got to start a new series.
Yeah, I mean, we can do whatever you want. We can do a filmmaker series or a genre thing or just
films that we like.
Yeah, we can do whatever.
Maybe we'll do another round. Like, maybe we'll just do films
that we like.
Films that we like.
I'm into that.
Let's do it. I just want to keep doing this with you. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. And I know we're going to see each other in September, which I'm super excited about.
Yes. Me too.
Our super secret hang.
In-person hangs.
With you and your lovely wife and Ben Harrison and his wife.
Yeah.
And
getting the gang back together.
And his wife.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really looking forward
all
to
the
that. It's fun to make plans and
amen.
And look forward to things again.
All right, dude. Well, this is great. This is going to come out in a couple of weeks.
Great.
Where can people follow you? I always like to plug your shit.
Well, I am known for two great podcasts at the moment. The Greatest Generation is my Star Trek podcast, and The Greatest Discovery is my new Star Trek podcast.
That's right.
And I like guesting on shows. So I'm a guest on my friends' shows like yours, and I can be found. I'm out there. I'm on Twitter at Cut for Time. You can follow me there.
Love that handle.
I think those are all the bases to cover.
All right. Fantastic, sir. So thank you, Adam. And
thanks, Chip.
For now, this concludes our PTA series until the new one comes out. Hope everyone has enjoyed it and checks out these movies. I'm sorry we didn't get to Punch Drunk Love. I don't do repeats. You can take it up with Tony Hale if you ever see him out.
Oh, yeah.
Punch that nice guy right in the face.
Tony Hale.
That'll be your first fist fight.
Yeah.
With the nicest guy in Hollywood.
I do not want to be that kind of famous.
All right. Thanks, bud.
Thank you.
Movie Crush is produced and written by Charles Bryant and Noel Brown, edited and engineered by Seth Nicholas Johnson, and scored by Noel Brown here in our home studio at Ponsonby Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.